about federal priorities. The Declaration of Independence asserts that the first duty of government is security, as it lays out self-evident truths, including unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Today, the lack of defense budget transparency is particularly harmful given the politics of U.S. government funding overall. As national policymakers continue to insist on budget agreements that mandate parity between defense and non-defense accounts in discretionary spending, appropriations other than entitlements and government debt service, they're looking at an inaccurate picture of that balance from the start. Midstream.
It is an exceptional opportunity for the Israeli Mossad, which never hesitates to penetrate the Lebanese arena in every way possible, especially since the financial and economic hardships that hit the country 3 years ago. It now can be said that Israel has fully invaded Lebanon with espionage. Over the past months, the Information Division of the Lebanese Internal Security Forces has been active in arresting networks dealing with the Mossad, whose number exceeded 185 as of the date of writing this report. The arrests Lebanon makes continues on an almost daily basis, to a point that this file of spy activity may require 2 years of arrests, and the number of detainees may exceed thousands. The Israeli entity has recruited a huge number of networks to an extent that the Mossad is facing a glut in its network of Lebanese spying agents. The Zionist Mossad has become so saturated with Lebanese spies that it dropped many of those moles at the first mistake they made, as per investigations with agents that the Mossad abandoned after they failed to serve on their very first case. Lebanese security sources revealed that this huge surge of spy activity increased in an unprecedented way with the onset of the economic crisis at the end of 2019. Since then, the Information Division has monitored large movements and contacts of Lebanese citizens from different sects and regions with the enemy. According to the Lebanese authorities, this surge is due to many reasons, the most prominent of which is the economic crisis affecting the lives of the Lebanese, which led to a decline in purchasing power and a decrease in the level of income, damaging the lifestyle to which they were accustomed to before the crisis. This new reality prompted many Lebanese to search for an external source of income in search of fresh U.S. dollars, albeit through online work or in exchange for some services that can be performed to earn a quick buck. Investigations with the detainees indicate that some of them explicitly admitted that they had resorted on their own free will to the Mossad and offered espionage services by communicating with the agency via its official website. Another reason for the surge in spy activity is the lack of job opportunities in Lebanon, which prompted a large segment of young people to look for jobs outside the country. Approximately 1 million citizens uploaded their resumes online during the past 4 years in search for job opportunities without knowing the destination to which they were sent, and most of them were poured into the Mossad database in one way or another. The number of detained spies in Lebanon is considered a record compared to previous years, which many observers interpret as an Israeli exploitation of the economic crisis that has dramatically increased poverty rates in Lebanon, allowing Zionist Israel to recruit traitors at a very cheap cost. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. 170 Israeli networks are under investigation out of thousands estimated by Lebanese security agencies to include more than 10,000 spies on Lebanese soil after Israel monitored more than a million CVs submitted by Lebanese citizens online during the past 3 years under the weight of the dire need for fresh U.S. dollar payments. The economic collapse in Lebanon has taken its toll on the country in many ways, but it seems that it is not the only reason for treason in this Middle Eastern country. Several collaborators admitted that they continued their collaboration with the Mossad out of sheer opposition to their national Lebanese resistance. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hassan Hijazi, expert in Zionist affairs and a political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Hijazi. Now, Lebanon has arrested 185 civilians suspected of working for the Israeli spy agency Mossad since October 2019. That's the year that our country, Lebanon, was battered by a severe economic crisis and financial tragedy. It is truly baffling for me to read these numbers, 185 in 3 years. However, are economic hardships in a country like Lebanon enough reason to betray one's country and to become a spy for the Israeli Mossad? I mean, this is an enemy that has carpet bombed their cities down to rubble many times, and they still want to be spies for Israel.
The economic factor plays a major role in the activity of the Zionist intelligence agencies and the Mossad in specific. The Mossad usually looks for opportunities within the crisis that hit Lebanon in order to recruit spies by presenting them with financial temptations. It does not necessarily have to be clear and direct implication process by the Mossad, but rather an exploitation of the financial hardship and the presentation of offers for different positions for fake companies that claim that they want to conclude work contracts with their new employees, and then they attract citizens who unknowingly apply for the job. The Mossad studies these people and learns about the nature of their work and the nature of their livelihood, and then chooses whomever they find fit to drag them into the quagmire of espionage. Then the occupation resorts to withdrawing information from these people about cases that may at first be normal issues, that do not suggest in any way to those who deal with this firm that they are dealing with the Israeli Mossad. Then the matter develops to further recruiting these people under the pretext of offering financial inducements to benefit from collecting sensitive information. At that point, people might realize that they have been implicated in a foreign intelligence service. They may not know whether it was the Mossad or another security agency. But in some cases, according to what the investigations revealed, some of the citizens discovered that they were dealing with the Zionist Mossad and decided to continue the espionage process. There is no doubt that the Zionist entity is taking advantage of the financial hardship, considering that this issue may provide a fertile ground for recruiting espionage agents. There are always those who might fall and become weak in front of financial temptations and urgent economic needs and dive further into the quagmire of espionage without realizing, in the end, the seriousness of this issue, only to discover after that they have been involved in a serious case that will take them to prison or even get them killed.
Well, Mr. Hijazi, although Lebanon remains technically in a state of war with the Zionist occupation, there has been no direct confrontation between the Lebanese side and the Zionist occupation side since the war in 2006. Nevertheless, Israel's espionage activities in Lebanon keep on just rising. They continue on and never cease. In what ways can that specifically hurt the government and the resistance as well?
The occupation is always in a state of preparation for war. It always considers the issue of collecting information part of its battle, even if the actual military battle is suspended. The occupation is aware of the sensitivity of the Lebanese reality in relation to the occupying entity. There is the force that Hezbollah has built on the political, military, and other levels, which poses a fundamental danger to the occupying entity. The occupation cannot ignore or overlook this critical matter. Israel mobilizes greater skills in order to collect information and learn about what might happen in this arena. Therefore, it may resort to methods to stir up strife and disagreements and strengthen the internal division amongst the Lebanese. This issue has direct effects on the political reality, because it contributes to inflaming public opinion and inciting the Lebanese against one another. We witnessed in the investigations with some of the spies that they were receiving sums of money in exchange for their activity on social media and in exchange for articles they wrote in the press to incite resistance and create a public opinion opposing and hostile to the resistance at home. Without a doubt, this issue has an impact on the political reality and increases the complications for the Lebanese government to get out of the crisis. The resistance is also aware of the sensitivity of this matter and is aware that the occupation is seeking to build a very large bank of targets around its sites and about the method of spreading its sensitive military equipment. Consequently, the resistance resorts to various methods to reduce the size of the penetration of the Zionists into the Lebanese arena and to prevent the occupation from building this bank of targets by blocking intelligence information. Mainly because the occupation greatly benefits from this information in any future war and transforms this information and translates it into targets that they end up striking on land, which often causes human casualties amongst civilians and destroys the Lebanese infrastructure, under the pretext that the occupation has some information about facilities that may belong to the resistance.
But how would the Lebanese resistance in Lebanon deal with such a growing challenge? I mean, let's say they were able to fixate a spy network. How would they deal with that?
The truth is that these issues are kept secret and we do not receive much information about them in the Lebanese media. However, there is clarity in the existing cooperation between the Resistance Security Service and the official Lebanese security services. There is an attempt to share information to take advantage of all the means available to the resistance in order to pursue these spying networks. There is a permanent and continuous effort to expose these networks and gather information about them in order to monitor any pathway through which the occupation can penetrate the Lebanese reality by recruiting agents, whether through the virtual space, through social media, or through the old traditional means of recruitment. The resistance is present in its capabilities and apparatuses at this level, and it cooperates with the security services in order to combat this phenomenon and pursue spying agents to block the Zionists from gathering information from the Lebanese arena, whether against the resistance or the state or other groups present operating in Lebanon. This cooperation aims to find the kind of mechanism that can mitigate the size of the Zionist penetration into the Lebanese arena.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hassan Hijazi, expert in Zionist affairs and political commentator, for joining us to talk about this very pressing matter inside Lebanon and against the Lebanese resistance. Thank you for your contribution.
Please stay tuned because next we will be talking how Jenin is facing Zionist fascism.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The closer the future Israeli government is to seeing light, the higher the level of terrorism and criminality is becoming in the occupied Palestinian territories, which would clearly outline the features of the new phase that the Palestinians are embarking on, which is filled with grim and dangerous challenges. Despite the weight of the massacre committed by the enemy last week in the Jenin camp, which caused grief and anger throughout Palestine, the resistance's insistence on clashing with the occupation and the state of popular support it enjoys, especially in the West Bank, indicate that the coming Israeli breaking waves aggression might not do more than what the first breaking waves had already done. Jenin faces Zionist fascism in this following report.
After a series of assassinations and arrests in Jenin and Nablus, the resistance in both cities is still sticking to its vow and position to continue resisting and confronting the Zionist occupation army with its incursions in the occupied areas of the West Bank. In the meantime, the resistance groups in the West Bank, especially the Jenin Brigades and the Lion's Den Battalions, are working to develop their military and security activities. Zionist media reported lately that the Palestinian fighters in the West Bank currently possess high-quality rifles, claiming that clashes that were once confined to rock-throwing have now become street gunfights. It was no coincidence that on Thursday, the 8th of December, the Palestinians bid farewell to five martyrs who were killed by the bullets of the occupation on the 35th anniversary of the outbreak of the First Palestinian Intifada. In a day burdened with sadness and anger that the occupied territories lived from north to south following the enemy's massacre in Jenin, which led to the fall of three new martyrs, Ata Shalabi, 46 years old, Tariq Dajem, 29 years old, and Sidqi Zakarne, 29 years old, during armed clashes described as the most violent this year. At the early hours of dawn on Friday, December 9, Zionist occupation patrols accompanied by huge military bulldozers stormed the city of Jenin and its camp from all entrances, occupied many buildings and set up sniper teams on top of them after special forces had infiltrated before them. Following the raid, which the enemy claimed was aimed at arresting one of the resistance fighters involved in the booby trapping of a vehicle that exploded weeks ago and was intended to carry out a commando operation, the resistance fighters engaged in armed clashes, during which they targeted the occupation forces with heavy bullets and homemade explosive devices, according to what was announced by the Martyr Izzedine al-Qassam Brigades and the Jenin Brigade and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, confirming that direct losses occurred among the enemy soldiers whose cries were heard by Jenin residents, while eyewitnesses confirmed the presence of Israeli ambulances at the site. The enemy's escalation of crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories comes at a time when the racist right-wing government is close to seeing light. The Jenin massacre coincided with the announcement that the Prime Minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu had reached an agreement with the religious right-wing Shas party to include it in the coalition, in exchange for its president Aryeh Deri taking over the interior and health ministries during the first half of the new government's term and the finance ministry in the second half. Thus, the pillars of the fascist coalition are completed, after Netanyahu also reached an agreement with the far-right religious Zionism party that its leader Bezalel Smotrich would assume the Ministry of Finance for a period of 2 years. This formation reinforces expectations that the occupied territories will witness an explosion that seems inevitable, in light of head of the Otzma Yehudit party, Itamar Ben-Gvir, and Bezalel Smotrich taking over the departments and ministries directly related to the Palestinians.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Jenin camp is Mr. Mohammad Jradat, political commentator and author. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mohammad. Now, it was no coincidence that last Thursday the Palestinians actually bid farewell to five martyrs who were killed by the bullets of the Zionist occupation, which coincided with the 35th anniversary of the First Intifada in occupied Palestine. What are the indications of such a fierce confrontation 35 years later?
Assalamu alaikum, yaatikum al-afiyah.
Peace be upon you. These brutal attacks launched by the Israeli occupation on Jenin have gone beyond last week to the present day. Tonight, for example, more martyrs fell successively, the last of which was the 15-year-old child martyr, Jana Zakarni, who was killed by the occupier with seven bullets while she was on the roof of her house during an attack on the Bayadir area in the city of Jenin. This brutal attack, which coincided with the 35th anniversary of the First Intifada, reflects Israel's insistence on eliminating the Palestinian people on the one hand, humiliating them, bringing them to their knees, and cauterizing their consciousness. On the other hand, the Palestinian people, through their available primitive capabilities, spare no effort in inflicting losses to the ranks of the Zionist enemy. On the other hand, the Palestinian people, through their available primitive capabilities, spare no effort in inflicting losses to the ranks of the Zionist enemy. Therefore, with every incursion into Jenin, in particular, and into Nablus, the resistance fighters who are armed with simple automatic rifles and young men carrying their stones are pouring into the streets and into the alleys to confront this fortified Israeli war mechanism, which is protected by drones and helicopters that storm the Palestinian areas to attack them and inflict as many losses as possible. Jenin, a small city in the north of the West Bank, presented more than 80 martyrs during these months. But it is a city in which the Jenin Brigade and young men from the Lions Brigades and Al-Quds Brigades took it upon themselves to restore the glow of resistance in the northern West Bank. Dozens of heroes emerged from among them who rubbed the nose of this occupier with dirt from time to time. This confrontation continues to this day. Today there was a security incident between the Israeli security services and the Jenin battalion, and so the series of confrontation continues until Allah wishes otherwise.
Mr. Muhammad, the enemy's escalation comes at a time when the racist right-wing government led by Benjamin Netanyahu is being prepared to be launched in the Zionist entity. We have seen Netanyahu doing agreements with the right-wing Shas party, the head of the party, Aryeh Deri, and also with other fascist coalition members. How will this be reflected on the Palestinian natives, especially in besieged Jenin right now?
The Shas Party, the Jewish Tzatura Party, and the Likud Party are normal parties in the frequent right-wing fascist Zionist governments. What is new in this brutal coalition formation is the entry of the Religious Zionist Party, with 14 seats in the Zionist Knesset. This development is the master of the situation. For Deri, the leader of Chas, to take over the Ministry of Health and Finance, who was previously arrested several times on the charges of corruption, theft and embezzlement, as are most of the leaders of Chas and Yehudi Tzatura, have been arrested in connection with thefts. It is surprising and strange that Itamar Ben-Gavir and Smotrich became in the first term in charge of the Ministry of Finance and the Civil Judiciary in the West Bank. We are talking about the West Bank security as seen inside the Israeli Ministry of War. Ben-Gavir takes over the Ministry of National Security with an expansion of powers. This very huge development is the master of the situation now, so that Netanyahu, although he appears as a swollen peacock, has become a hostage and captive in the hands of those whom the Israeli Knesset has never included. In 1984, Kahana entered the Knesset and was expelled by Shamir and the Knesset members at the time. But today we see Smotrich and Ben-Gavir entering the Knesset, who are Kahana's students. They call for the death of the Arabs and for the burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they call for all the racist slogans that the Zionist entity has never reached before. Here they are on the Knesset seats and on the seats of active ministries in the government. They control the heartbeat of the Palestinian people, not only in the occupied interior but also in the West Bank. Therefore, this turmoil will undoubtedly be reflected in the development of events in Jenin, Nablus and the West Bank, so that the clash continues and we may even witness a boiling state in the coming months when this unprecedented fascist camp in the history of this entity takes over the military and security field. Today, the Israeli police, which Ben-Gavir will lead, has a military base in the heart of the Israeli army in the south. This means that Ben-Gavir's Al-Yammam unit and the border guard will be more active in the northern part of the West Bank, igniting the region in a broader way. When the Palestinian martyr Ammar was executed a few days ago in the Hawara accident, the criminal Ben-Gavir tweeted and considered that the killing of Ammar was a blessed operation, even though it was a crime that took place in broad daylight in front of the entire world and was, without any doubt, a cold-blooded execution.
Well, in any case, the recent weeks in the West Bank have laid down a very clear equation based on which the Israeli policy in the future will be against the Palestinian natives, that it will depend on more terrorism, just like the operation that you just spoke about right now, the actual execution of a Palestinian in the broad daylight in the streets of occupying Palestine. Will this fact have any implications on the normalizing Arab regimes with the Zionist entity who made the famous or infamous, if I may, Abraham Accord?
The normalizing regimes with the occupation entity have removed all masks from their faces. Recently, the right-wing fascist Zionist parties organized visits to Al-Aqsa Mosque and invited the ambassadors of the countries of the world. The UAE ambassador was actively involved, while the ambassadors of the European Union, for example, abstained. Europe has realized that it is facing a racist political and security development unprecedented in the history of international relations in the region. But the United Arab Emirates, for example, did not realize this. Turkey, in the words of Erdogan, have said that his government congratulated Netanyahu and said that this government is the one that will make peace. Therefore, when we talk about the current countries of normalization, these countries do not care about all these developments inside Palestine. They are countries that look after their own interests, although there are no interests in reality, because there is no real relationship between the Zionist entity and these countries. We have seen the Arab peoples, the Arab teams and the Arab masses at the World Cup in Qatar, how they celebrated and still celebrated the Palestinian flag and the injustice afflicting Palestine, and we saw how they were all hostile to the Israeli presence that overwhelmed Qatar from one end to the other. Therefore, unfortunately, these countries, including Bahrain, received Herzog after the last elections. These countries support these fascist developments within the Israeli camp. So the Arab nation, whether at the level of the region, the Middle East, and the world as a whole, is facing two sides, and there is no third side. Either you are on the side of the Palestinian people, or you are against them. There is no gray area.
Definitely. Definitely, Mr. Jiradat, there is no gray area when it comes to Palestine. It's either with it or against it, and we know our place very well. We are with the Palestinian people, we are with you, we support you, and we wish you victory against this fascist terrorist entity. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammad Jiradat, political commentator and author, for joining us from Jenin to talk about how Jenin is facing this Zionist fascism. And I want to thank you very much for joining us to talk about very pressing and important matters right here in West Asia. Thank you for always listening to what we have to provide to you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream. See you again next week. Assalamu alaikum.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's military frequently carries out wide-ranging arrest campaigns across the West Bank under the pretext of searching for wanted Palestinians. Thousands of Palestinians are held in Israeli regime jails, and hundreds have been imprisoned under administrative detention. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "Detention without trial defined apartheid South Africa's notorious jailing of political opponents without regard for human rights or due process, an unsavory act to intimidate and crush resistance by activists viewed as threats to white supremacy. Detention and without trial was used in response to growing militancy by the liberation movements led by ANC and PAC. Though it initially was limited to 12 days of detention without trial, it was extended to 90 days and later to 180 days. Not satisfied with the limited time, apartheid securocrats finally changed it to allow for indefinite detention without trial. While this era of abuse, torture and death in detention ended with the dawn of democracy, the same cannot be said about the fabricated regime of Israel, where detention without trial is routinely practiced in violation of the rights of Palestinian detainees. Although the Zionist regime, the settler colonial regime in occupation of Palestine, refers it to as administrative detention in an effort to soften outrage against it, it remains as notorious as South Africa's detention without trial. Administrative detention orders are issued by the military and approved by military courts on the basis of secret evidence. Consider the irony of Israel, hailed by the US, Europe, and supporters in South Africa, subjecting Palestinians to military courts. And worse, applying Gestapo tactics by withholding evidence concealed as secret from both Palestinian detainees and their legal teams. Reminiscent of the apartheid era's 180 days, Zionist military courts issue detention orders for up to 6 months at a time. The arbitrary powers wielded by the jailers make the period renewable indefinitely. Palestinians, including minor children, spend years jailed without charge or trial under administrative detention. It is thus not uncommon to see hundreds of Palestinians going on a hunger strike to secure their freedom and raise outrage and awareness of the cruelty of arbitrary detention. Though illegal under international law, the Zionist regime continues to defy conventions with impunity. The cruelty associated with administrative detention is a form of psychological torture and collective punishment targeting Palestinian families as detainees are unable to predict or plan their release. The current case of French-Palestinian lawyer Salah Hamouri, ordered once again to administrative detention at Hamadrim prison as a political prisoner, is a damning indictment of the Zionist regime's tyranny. Hamouri is one of approximately 820 Palestinians jailed without charge or trial under administrative detention out of 4,750 total Palestinian political prisoners in the prior regime's jails. Also, he was one of the six Palestinian human rights defenders who were proven to be illegally surveilled through the infamous Pegasus spyware. As was the case in South Africa, detention without trial or administrative detention draws its legacy from British colonialism, adopted and significantly improvised to exert maximum pressure on detainees. The Zionist regime applies it on Palestinians with impunity and in total disregard for international law. According to Tasnim News Agency, the Israeli regime has detained over 50,000 Palestinian children since the occupation of the West Bank and East al-Quds in 1967, the Palestine Liberation Organization has said. The PLO Detainees Affairs Commission recently said the majority of children were arrested from their homes at night hours, while others were arrested from the streets or on their way to school or back home. Out of that figure, the commission said virtually 160 children are still being held behind bars in Israeli regime detention centers. Among the detainees are three girls, of whom two are 16 years old and the third is 17. Some others are held under the Zionist regime's administrative detention, which allows incarcerating Palestinian inmates without trial or charge. The Palestinian Prisoners Society, PPS, said in a statement recently, the Zionist regime military forces had arrested more than 750 Palestinian children in the West Bank and East al-Quds since the beginning of the current year. The PPS said most of the children have been subjected to all forms of physical and psychological torture during detention in violation of international agreements and conventions on the rights of children. The Israeli Regime Prison Service, IPS, keeps Palestinian prisoners under deplorable conditions, lacking proper hygienic standards. The prisoners have also been subjected to systematic torture, harassment, and repression all through the years of Israeli regime's occupation of the Palestinian territories.
Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
During the recent unrest in Iran, local officials have often mentioned two words, hybrid warfare, allegedly conducted by the U.S. and its allies. These hybrid methods of warfare have consisted of propaganda, deception, sabotage, and guerrilla military tactics. Of course, these methods have long been used to destabilize adversaries. What is new about them seen in recent events is their speed, scale, and intensity, facilitated by rapid technological support and global interconnectivity. Additionally, there is a high degree of concentration on an aspect called cognitive warfare. In cognitive warfare, the human mind becomes the battlefield. The aim is to change not only what people think, but how they think and act. Conducted successfully, it shapes and manipulates individual and group beliefs and behaviors to favor an instigator's tactical or strategic schemes.
The increasingly widespread use of satellite networks, social media, and mobile device technologies is now enabling cognitive warfare as a new domain. The Islamic Republic of Iran is facing such threats and challenges by both state and non-state actors who use these media and tools to target political institutions, influence public mind, and undermine Iranian citizens' security. To analyze the effectiveness of this new warfare, please stay with us on this edition of Iran Today.
The aims of cognitive warfare can be limited with a short duration, or they can be strategic, with several campaigns conducted over the course of decades. A single campaign could focus on the limited aim of disrupting entire societies or ethnic unions by seeding doubts about governance, destabilizing democratic processes, triggering civil disturbances, or instigating separatist movements.
In the past, a war scenario would happen and the media would interpret it in line with the power's desires. But after a while, the real battle took place in the media. Media would picture a fake battle, and based on that false image, the destiny of a country and a nation could change. We recently faced a new phenomenon called the color revolution or velvet coup. The media would set up a made-up scenario and by showing that, they could change the destiny of a nation. This shows the growing importance of the media in the battle between nations and superpowers.
The advantage in cognitive warfare goes to whoever then makes the first move and chooses the time, place, and means of the offensive. Cognitive warfare can be done using a variety of adaptable paths and media sources. The openness of social media platforms allows adversaries to easily target individuals, selected groups, and the public through social messaging, social media influencing, selective release of documents, video sharing, etc. Cyber capabilities allow the use of spear phishing attacks, hacking, and tracking of individuals and social networks.
Barak Ravid, an Israeli contributing correspondent at the American news website called Axios, did some whistleblowing in a series of tweets. He stated that Mossad, a terrorist organization, asked the Iran International Satellite Channel to increase its anti-Iranian activities. Ravid said that Iran International Channel is the Mossad hand in Iran issues. Why would Mossad invest in a TV channel? Well, the reason is that the enemy wants to do its operations relevant to our authority, place and performance in the region, so we wouldn't have this position anymore, and it's using the media as part of its plan.
A couple of days ago, Iran Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian described the recent riots as a scheme by U.S. and some other Western governments to force Iran to make major concessions in the talks on the revival of 2050 nuclear deal. Amir Abdullahian pointed out that Iran is a democratic country. Amir Abdullahian added that Iran is a country that uses democratic process, adding that we hear and respond to the peaceful demands of Iran people. But we do not allow anyone to incite riots and carry out acts of terrorism in our country.
Our enemies like the U.S., European countries like England and Arab kingdoms that have committed many crimes against their own people and other countries. The supporters of Daesh planning for sedition had hired many people. Mrs. Clinton, in her book Hard Choices, says that we trained 5,000 Iranians. They were given guns, as John Bolton said, guns were distributed inside Iran, asking them to set banks or police cars on fire for a prize, paying them with cryptocurrencies. They provide motives for murders and terror. The death of Mahsa Amini was just an excuse. They would find another excuse if this hadn't happened.
During the last few months, different news agencies, including Western Persian language media, have been putting out stories on mainstream or social media that raise unfair allegations against the Islamic Republic of Iran. According to geopolitical experts, the U.S. and some Western countries are trying to induce disorder and mutiny in Iran by supporting and equipping hostile groups and enemies, arming them and providing them facilities and intelligence. The antagonist content published in the media covers various issues, including nuclear energy, human rights, ethnicities, and overall security.
What recently happened in our country, the enemy media played the role of atomic bombs, meaning that they committed a criminal act in an attempt to take over a country and a nation. You witnessed that some of the European state-sponsored media, which some may assume are the symbol of human rights, supported these criminal activities.
These groups and media have continuously encouraged unrest and disorder in Iran for the past few months and have gone so far as teaching civilians how to make a variety of incendiary weapons such as Molotov cocktails. They even go all out to tell people to infringe on state buildings and disarm Iran's military and security personnel and kill them when they can.
There's some media out there that reflect these as well, teaching how to make bombs and Molotov cocktails or giving assassination orders. For sure, authorities of the other countries would know these things. They know and grant permission for these activities so they can oppose any country that is independent and follows its national benefits.
So we currently have classic media like BBC, Iran International and Radio Farda, while we also have accounts of some cyber armies which are getting support from the Saudis and the Zionist regime army, with the Pentagon and the Intelligence Ministry of Saudis leading them. Not only these, but we also have rental accounts. So this shows we have the heaviest hybrid invasion in history on our hands right now.
Regardless of the never-ending politicized allegations about the Islamic Republic of Iran in the Western media, the reality is something else. During the past four decades or so, the Iranian people have endured the cruelest sanctions just because they want to enjoy their right to peaceful atomic energy. Despite complying with international obligations, Iran has faced maximalist pressure campaigns consisting of thousands of sanctions imposed by the last three U.S. administrations and their allies. Furthermore, many Iranian scientists, in addition to General Qasem Soleimani, Iran's hero in the fight against Daesh terrorism, have been assassinated by the U.S. and Israel.
I should also mention the attempt by the Americans and Zionists in the media for normalization of terrorism isn't a new thing. If you go back to 2006 and 2007, Abdul Malik Righi, the leader of the Jundullah terrorist group, would have an interview in the VOA as a civil and political activist. VOA called him the leader of People's Movement in Iran. People haven't forgotten these things. Or, for example, Radio Fardo, which introduces itself as an organization associated with the CIA, is introducing different terrorists as civil activists.
After the coronavirus pandemic, at a time when Iran was trying to recover and revive its economy and social resources, the unfortunate death of an Iranian woman led to a major controversial campaign against the Islamic Republic. In this atmosphere, the United States and its allies, using their media, contrary to all the principles and rules of international law, have called for turmoil against Iran and asked protesters to resort to aggressive measures, destroying urban infrastructure and public and private properties. At the same time, Iranian law enforcement forces were killed due to the riots and by cold weapons or direct gunfire in the streets. According to the law, these people were just doing their legal duties to establish and maintain order.
Their goal is to produce lies. As I'm talking to you right now, it has been estimated that Iranian opposition media are producing a lie against people every 2 minutes. Today, a terrorist named Rahnavard was executed in Mashhad for stabbing and killing two of our Basiji forces, namely Mr. Zinyalzadeh and Rezazadeh, with a knife. These two were helping people during the riots to protect their properties. A criminal person kills these two youths with a knife on the street. Now, let's check what these Farsi-speaking media are saying about Rahnavard. They made him a hero and a political activist and wouldn't call him a murderer. This very fact shows the nature of their mission and what they want to achieve.
Meanwhile, media reports indicate that cross-border smuggling of weapons and ammunition into Iran, destruction of public property, disruption of the democratic processes and public order, arson, vandalism, threat, intimidation, assault and battery, assassination, terror and lynching are only parts of the destructive and illegal actions taken by these so-called freedom fighters and defenders of human rights. Experts have suggested that most of the weapons used were foreign and came from outside the country. The overall scheme seemed to have been to disrupt order and security within the territories of the Islamic Republic.
The disintegration of a country is a hated act. Tearing apart nations and putting people against each other is obnoxious. But you would see this same action from some of the state-sponsored media like BBC. London-based media like Saudi International issue police force assassination orders in front of their cameras, stating that this is the people's right to kill a police officer who lawfully should implement social order.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There is plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media.
Here is how it looks on the page. Anadolu Agency says Iran may phase out morality police but mandatory hijab to stay. Mohammad Jafar Montazeri, Iranian Attorney General, said that the morality police force has nothing to do with the judiciary and was put to a standstill from the same place it was set up, referring to the Supreme Council of Cultural Revolution, an influential government body. The top prosecutor, however, hastened to add that the judiciary will continue to oversee the observance of behavioral patterns at the community level, a subtle signal that the mandatory dress code may remain in place whether or not the morality force survives. IRNA says Iran sets deadline for Meta to introduce representative for country. Iran has sent a letter to U.S. technology company Meta, giving it 10 days after receiving the letter to take necessary measures in order for the company's platforms to continue activities in Iran. The letter written by the Supreme Council of Cyberspace also raised issues on which Iran had expressed protests against Meta. The issue include disseminating false news, instigating discriminatory behaviors and spreading hatred, provoking unrest, violating Iran's national sovereignty and rights of users through applying double standards, and paving the ground for campaigns by terrorist groups and social media platforms affiliated to Meta. Noor News says the U.S. military uses fake people to deceive global public opinion. Meta Platforms company with the brand name Meta, with 2.8 billion users, most of whom are members of the popular platforms such as Instagram, WhatsApp, and Facebook, recently announced the U.S. military is deceiving people with fake accounts on Instagram and Facebook. The company's security experts have identified several groups of fake accounts that appear to be active as legal accounts and also operate on a wide range of other social networks such as Twitter, YouTube, and Telegram, but in fact do not belong to a specific real person. Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Yemen, Syria, and Algeria are mentioned in the explanation of these areas covered by the fake accounts of the U.S. Army as a target of these operations. Their content is mainly published in Persian, Arabic, and Russian languages using videos, slides, and articles. Previously, Western thinkers had talked about the way of managing public opinion and how false or even true news, images, and analyses can direct people's thoughts and minds in a calculated and selective manner. In the recent unrest in Iran, some media outlets, which naturally should be doing news, have become the coordination headquarters of rioters. For instance, the London-based Iran International, also known as the Saudi International within the Iranian circles, airs hostile messages, which are in contrast with Iran's national interest. It is observed by media experts that if a medium produces hatred instead of journalistic messages, it means that it has entered the scene with a special mission. The directors of Iran International have openly said they seek to topple the ruling system in Iran. In light of this type of approach, the Saudi-funded outlet has become an artillery that fires bullets instead of messages, promoting violence and trying to legitimize attacks on security forces under the name of the right to defense.
Right now, apart from Farsi-speaking opposition media, we have about 800,000 social media accounts that are promoting opposition activities, and 32,000 of these accounts are active and creating content each day. Apart from this cyber army, they also buy social accounts of the great part of the society or rent their accounts. For example, some celebrities were asked why were they so active in these riots while before it everything was normal for you. These ladies and gentlemen would say, we aren't aware of these activities in our accounts. It turned out that because they gave their accounts to an admin, it was the admins who took control and under the name of those celebrities would publish posts and narratives.
Accordingly, it has been reported by The Guardian that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who many believe is responsible for the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, is the force behind Iran International. The station, which is operating out of Chiswick in London, has not denied claims that it receives its funding from the Saudi royal court.
For example, removing Press TV from some of the satellites, on the surface it seems to be against Press TV, but in reality it's against their people, not letting them hear a different voice. Let's not forget, countries that claim they are defending Iranian women's freedom are the same ones that, for instance, in places like France, can't tolerate hijab, and those with hijab can't work and study freely. They have the blood of millions on their hands. What did France do in Algeria, or England in many countries, including India, or the US in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? These countries have become defenders of human rights.
In a time when Europe hosts many channels that instigate violence and terrorism against Iran, European satellite operator Eutelsat decides to take the English language news network Press TV off the air. Yet another example of the West double standards, which is blatantly in conflict with the principles of freedom of expression. It is interesting to know that Ofcom, which regulates broadcasting media in the UK, has so far closed its eyes on the unlawful acts of the London-based terrorist TV channel Iran International. After all, promoting violence, encouraging murder and chaos, and teaching how to overthrow a government is entirely against the regulations of this entity.
Unfortunately, in Iran, the government doesn't have enough consideration of the importance of the media. We need to have an effective media. Those who compare our media with other countries, such as England or Saudi Arabia, should ask, how much support do our media get? How are they being evaluated by governmental organizations? Also, the infrastructural hardware supportive measures alongside the professional media programming can turn the future in our favor and immune us to any vulnerability.
In a recent comprehensive study done by the Fars News Agency, the performance of a few media outlets, including the BBC Persian affiliated with the British government, Iran International affiliated with the Saudi government, Voice of America, Radio Farda, and Manoto affiliated with the American government, show that they have published a total of 17,312 lies over 25 days about the recent events in Iran. In the survey, only the official website, Telegram channel, Twitter, and Instagram accounts of these media outlets were examined, and their TV networks were not included. The results indicated that the BBC Persian had a total of 58% lies, Iran International had a total of 53% lies, Manoto Network had a total of 49% lies, Voice of America had a total of 43% lies, Radio Farda had a total of 41% lies. Thus, over the observed 25 days period, on average, 48.8% of the news published by these media were false. That is, almost one out of every two pieces was fake news and disinformation. Furthermore, the five lies that were republished the most include the false claim about beating Mahsa Amini while in custody, false claims about the death of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, false claim about the fall of the city of Oshnaviyeh in West Azerbaijan province in Iran, false claim about the cause of Nikash Shakarami's death, the false claim about Sharif University bloodshed.
Here is where we say these opposition media produce a lie each minute and feed it to the people purposefully. Their purpose is to turn the great section of the society and people who are watching and are silent into an active opposition force. These people will not bond with the riot network easily. So to achieve this, there must be a media bridge for them. This type of media connection can be achieved with the same network I described earlier.
Filtering is like a prescription that can turn into an opportunity. We should have been better prepared. We can't abandon our people in this media invasion. We had to take some action. Fundamental measures are those 3 points I mentioned earlier. But at the same time, we do need some short-term actions to limit the opposition media and protect our nation from a sudden cyber invasion to some extent.
Meanwhile, in the latest attempt to sow discord between Iranian ethnicities, Islamic Republic's enemies assassinated the Sunni cleric Molavi Abdulwahid Righi, a supporter of the Islamic Revolution. He was abducted and murdered by unidentified persons in the Iranian province of Sistan and Balochistan. The Sunni scholar was previously informed of threats made against him by various anti-government groups.
This hybrid warfare pretends to sell the BBC Persian network as a savior of the Iranian people, or the Iran International Network uses sympathy to bond itself with a great section of the society. But in the end, when we look at their actions, we see that they are moving towards the same slogan in the years 2011 and 2012 in Syria, which said that we are looking to destroy the establishment. But with this approach in Iran, it doesn't mean that they want to overthrow the government in Iran or only change the political structures, but they want to disintegrate Iran to the extent that there won't be a country named Iran on the map anymore, and you would have a different spectrum of people in regions like Kurdistan or Khuzestan torn apart.
Righi said that not even one member of the mosque